It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up 9 o'clock, Ian Belknap and Lindsay Moscato come back with Right Club. They've exported their live lit show, one of the most successful shows in Chicago. It's at the Hideout. It's packed. It's essentially two writers take on one topic. So you have, like, you know, what they're going to do tonight, rise and fall. And they do it on stage, and it's such a good time, and it's one of the best shows in Chicago. It's written up. Everybody loves it. And they've started new Right Clubs in different cities. And tonight is the first time that they're bringing it to the radio, which is a perfect thing. I mean, we're going to have two writers in, one that will represent Rise, the other will represent Fall, and then 312-981-7200. You at home decide which one you like better. The winner gets nothing. Pete's got a bunch of good prizes, but I just feel bad about giving writers prizes. I feel like, you know, prize enough that they, I don't know, wrote something. From one writer to another. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. Also, we'll talk with Panjanovic somewhere in there, too, about the Matt Forte and the Chicago Bulls All-Star break as well. Well, my guest tonight at the big table is a writer and human rights activist. And, you know, he's not fighting for justice and equality in faraway lands or third world countries. No, Jamie Calvin's work is right here in Chicago. He's the man behind the Invisible Institute and the Citizens Police Data Project, which has just awarded the highly coveted Night News Challenge grant $400,000 to continue their work on making police misconduct information accessible and, in the bigger picture, reforming police accountability. Calvin has been working on behalf of Chicago's voiceless for decades. He's fought this fight on several levels. He's taken the fight to academics. He's set up shop in the CHA housing to be an advocate for residents. And recently, he took on politicians, police, prosecutors, in breaking the story of Laquan McDonald. He's the first journalist to get the autopsy report, which really will forever change the way police and the public interact. Jamie Calvin has also been a source for journalists in town to hook up with voices that are not usually heard, or to bring journalists into communities to gain access and observe firsthand. I was one of those journalists back in I think it was 1999, somewhere around 98, 99. And what we did is Jamie and I worked on an audio documentary about the final days of Stateway Garden, which was at 35th and State Street. I was just a public radio producer who was tasked with covering the city, but admittedly, I was 23, maybe. You know, I had not seen the city. I have no, like, be honest about that. So I didn't really know it. But I saw in that experience a part of the city that kind of helped me understand where I live. And I'll be forever grateful for that experience. And Jamie Calvin, he's my guest tonight at the big table. Jamie, good to see you.
It's great to be with you.
First of all, let's talk about the grant. Congratulations, $400,000 from the Night News Challenge to continue the work that really came out of your lawsuit to get the FOIAs public for misconduct files from the police department.
Right. There's a 10-year legal battle that culminated in Calvin versus Chicago, a decision of the Illinois Appellate Court that established the principle that police misconduct records belong to the public.
Right. Before that, they...
And, you know, the city had fiercely resisted and fought forever to releasing that information. So this is a major, major,
major
legal watershed. And when it came down, I mean, it was extraordinary and wonderful. I love that my name is associated with it. I'm not one for titles, but I kind of like Calvin versus Chicago, and and after it came down, I and my colleagues sort of confronted a challenge because we now had access to this information, you know, loads and loads,
just
right. You know, extraordinary amount.
And you've seen some stories come out of that. I mean, we've seen
there've been tons of stories.
Yeah, all the local journalists said because that was opened up. You've seen
right.
So a lot of the stories you've seen about misconduct in police officers, or even the information that the police officer involved in the Laquan McDonald had a record
right.
of misconduct.
So everybody now uses this information.
Right.
And what we confronted after this great and in some ways unexpected victory was the case established a principle of transparency. This belongs to the public. But, you know, that's like saying you're free because you have the First Amendment. If you don't exercise the First Amendment, you know, you're not free. And so our challenge was how to operationalize that principle of transparency.
Right.
And that's what led to the creation of the Citizens Police Data Project. And I urge people to Google it and take a look at it, because a lot of effort, care, thought, design, analytic capacity went into building this in the hope that we could create something that made this information immediately useful to multiple constituencies, obviously lawyers, journalists, but above all citizens, mm-hmm. that this could be a tool.
Because really it's just by releasing the information, it's just a data dump. If you don't actually categorize it or make it look good, yeah. people are never going to see
it. If we just put up Excel files of the information, right. it's the same information, a handful of people would be able to use it. So a lot of care has gone into building a really welcoming, inviting, interesting, engaging web interface and tools for people to explore the data. So that's the work that the Knight Foundation, you know, we entered into this competition that the Knight Foundation holds every year, the Knight News Challenge. And, you know, I think it was like 1,400 applicants or something people submitted. And in the end, they chose, I'm not sure the exact number, I think there were 8 major projects that they funded. So it's a, you know, mm-hmm. really intense
yeah, right.
competition. And they provided us with funding to continue to build this public resource. And, you know, you're a journalist. You know that most journalists, when they get information like this through Freedom of Information Act requests, actually then hold on to it and treat it as proprietary.
Right.
Even something like the NSA paper, you know, that's still
work. I mean, we just had Mick and Ben in here talking yeah. about the work that it takes to get
yeah,
a FOIA.
You sort of, you know, you think of yourself as a kind of agent of the public interest, but most, you know, any newspaper, most people would hold on to this, harvest it for stories. I intervened in court, in federal court and then state court on behalf of the public. And our stance is that when we said public, we meant public, that this information belongs to the public. That's the
not to journalists, not to people who can just read the stuff.
And
right.
so we're sort of curators of the information.
Right.
We're stewards. We take care of it. We keep building this public resource. And that's kind of the spirit in which we approach the Knight Foundation. This is a public, it's like the national parks or something. You know, this belongs to the public. And
that's
we
a great
need to
way
make
to put it.
We need to make it accessible, usable, legible to the public.
Jamie Calvin's my guest at the big table tonight. Let's take a break. When we come back, let's start at the beginning. I mean, let's talk about your career. I also want to talk about your time at the CHAB from the ground, the whole thing. Jamie Calvin, writer and human rights activist, the man behind the Invisible Institute and the Citizens Police Data Project, in studio tonight. Stay with us. That was a tough one for me, Pete. I don't know what happened there. I love that place. There's so much. You tripped up on one word,
well,
yak,
the,
and all
mean,
that.
The duck feet and the heat.
There's a lot going on there.
The
hips and the yak. I guess tonight.
It's like performance.
Jamie Calvin's a writer and human rights activist. He's the man behind the Invisible Institute and also the Citizens Police Data Project, which just got the Knight News Challenge, $400,000 to help, I guess, streamline and create more technology and tools to like get the public to interact with this material.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a strangely, it's a project that has a kind of twin aspect in that we're using technology and sort of advanced technology to make this information available. It's also really important that it be a kind of person-to-person organizing mm-hmm. strategy. So Knight's supporting that as well, the sort of outreach and building relationships that enable people to make really productive use of the data. I mean, you know, journalists and lawyers within like 48 hours of the launch of the database were making use of it.
Right.
Just being cited in story after story, not about us, but about
you were just police.
You provide
the app, right.
And within less than a week, lawyers were attaching exhibits to their motions in civil rights cases drawn from the database. I think to get citizens, especially in the neighborhoods most affected, where people are just so alienated from the police and from any notion that they could effectively get redress when
right.
abuse occurs. That's really where this Knight money
where it all comes
is
from.
Go.
And it even goes back in your career.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back. I mean, I want to talk about your dad and I want to talk about, you know, finishing his work in the 70s and 80s. But there's really kind of draws from your time at CHA, at Stately Gardens.
So, you know, it's even kind of stunning to me to look back. But where this story begins is in high-rise public housing, the last chapter of high-rise public housing, when you and I first met, you know, the last 10 years, mm-hmm. plan for transformation, the city commits to a policy of tearing down all of high-rise public housing.
So this would be when, you know, on the, if you're going down the Dan Ryan Stateway Gardens, yeah. Robert Taylor Homes.
So you have this extraordinary, I mean, to now it takes an act of imagination to remember what was here,
right.
You know, where you came to visit me. You had a more than 2 mile concentration of high rise after high rise after high rise along South State Street, referred to as South State Street Corridor. And it was in precisely the footprint of the old Black Belt, you know, under segregation. The poorest, you know, it was the largest concentration of poverty in the country, largest concentration of public housing in the country. I've used the image of like an armada of boat people offshore. I mean, it was just this amazing, amazing phenomena in the middle of the city, but it might as well have been the other side of the
right.
moon for most people. People saw it driving.
People saw it driving by.
On the expressway.
Yeah, right,
because
right.
these developments, both south side and west side, were sort of contained by expressway moats. They functioned as kind of moats, and that's where people saw it.
It's hard for me to fathom for people in Chicago not remembering that, because that was such a big part of the city, even architecturally coming in from the big expressways to be able to see that. But that's so
but
interesting.
The
it's
downs,
not
you know,
there.
But think about it. It's so disappeared. I mean, it's as disappeared as the Warsaw Ghetto disappeared. And so, you know, I spent many years there, as you know, immersed and had an office and was there daily. And over time, I witnessed patterns of policing and just daily forms of abuse, of excessive force, brutality, kind of racist utterance, open corruption, you know, shaking down young men in the drug trade and not making arrests. And what was, you know, it was a cumulative thing. It wasn't like a light bulb went off. It's over time you see it. And what I saw... And I saw it in the flesh and in this visceral form, and it was not a word I used at the time. I saw what impunity looks like. You know, impunity is this concept really important in human rights work of no fear of consequences. You know, the freedom to abuse people, toy with people, exploit people, violate their rights without any fear of consequences, that there would be discipline or punishment or that you even be identified. High-rise public housing at the end of, you know, in that final chapter, there was complete impunity for abusive officers. They could do anything that they wanted. And so the question that formed for me in the precise years when you and I, you know, worked together was what set of, I know I'm seeing this, I'm, you know.
Yeah,
I'm
saw
a,
it. Yeah.
I'm a professional observer. Yeah. I'm there every day. I see it year after year. I'm documenting it. I know this is real. What set of institutional conditions would have to exist? How would the world have to be organized for this actually to be happening?
Because we're talking about, I mean, and you see it could be, you know, squads that would just pop in. And to give a picture, and I remember this so starkly, but I mean, when it would get darker, a lot of, I mean, it was kind of like an open drug trade.
Oh, that was the one, it was
so
a vice zone.
This isn't like, not everyone was innocent.
It was a vice zone. No, it was allowed to be a vice zone. And it was contained, it was like, my understanding of how the townships were policed in South Africa under apartheid, it was a containment strategy.
So they contained it, said, this is where there's going to be.
And as you long can as hear, it doesn't spill out.
And I remember it so vividly, the calls.
Yeah.
So there'd be like a call, like, they wouldn't say heroin, but whatever the
No, they would say, they would actually say the name. So every drug line in every building, there were names for different brands of drugs. And, you know, they would be bizarre. The most popular heroin in the building where I had my office was called Dogface. So you have people like medieval criers shouting out Dogface, 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 or Titanic, or USDA, or actually one of the, during the run-up to the 2008 campaigns, one of the, you know, the national campaign, one of the most popular drug lines on the South Side was called Obama. So there's all these different brands. And the guys actually wore, you know, Yes We Can T-shirts and sweatshirts right. as a form of advertising. And when challenged, they could say, oh, no, we're just supporting the black candidate from the South Side.
Well, and so what you saw there was police coming into that environment. So there could be an argument to be said that they kind of created this area that was a cordoned off area that was for drugs. And yes, they operated in impunity because everything about it was illegal.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think one of the things we know about police abuse, both various forms of brutality and exploitation of people and corruption, is it does tend to gravitate towards the drug trade. I mean, the war on drugs has created a space for various kinds of abuse. I would also say, though, that, you know, we're going to talk some more about the failures of supervision, investigation, discipline, and a lot of my work has been focused on that and documenting it, and, you know, our database is about that. But it's important to also remember that what really ultimately confers impunity on abusive officers is the social status of the victims.
Yeah.
So, if you have a population as abandoned, disenfranchised, stigmatized, assumed to be criminal as people in public housing, the police can do
assumed to be criminal, because that's really where the turning point was as well, because you would see families or working mothers or people who had nothing to do, and you knew this from being in they had nothing to do with what was happening in the drug trade, and they were treated the same way.
Absolutely. And you know, that was a population mostly of women and children. And you had men who were mostly nomadic, not on the lease, and you had this underground criminal economy. But what tended to happen radically happened in public perception of those communities, which were communities, as you came to know, as complex, as rich in human variety as any community. So, you know, were there monsters there? Sure, like there are in Highland Park. But there were also lovely people who it would be, you know, make your life to know, and everything in between. And our vision of those places became so one-dimensional that these were they weren't even communities. They were criminal conspiracies, and everybody was implicated.
Well, let's take a break. We'll hit the news here, and then when we come back, let's talk more about that. Jamie Calvin is a writer and human rights activist. He's a man behind Invisible Institute and the Citizens Police Data Project, which just won a $400,000 grant from the Knight News Challenge. When we come back, more with Jamie Calvin here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me, Jamie Calvin, writer, human rights activist, man behind the Invisible Institute, also the Citizens Police Data Project, which just was awarded the highly coveted Knight News Challenge grant, $400,000, to bring more of the information that they have about police misconduct to the masses, to the public, which is who you were advocating for. Jamie, we had the news stopped this conversation about the CHA and about your time there. And what was interesting about it, we were getting to that, was supervision.
Yeah.
Because you do have police officers who, you know, are working with impunity because they do feel like they've set up an illegal kind of drug trade, and they're kind of need to be in control of it. So all bets are off. But when we think about that, there have to be police I wouldn't go as high as superintendents, but sergeants and bosses and others that sort of are in charge of those police officers.
Right. And I think that's the issue that we began to explore through litigation, through investigative journalism, is, you know, what kind of structures or absence of structures would allow for this to be going on? I mean, after all, the police are a paramilitary organization with, you know, all these levels of authority, and people give orders, and yet this kind of behavior is going in certain spaces.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, there's no rogue.
So what's going on? And so what a lot of the focus of my work since then has been on, and colleagues, and a lot of the litigation we've been involved in multiple federal civil rights suits, has been challenging the sort of systemic conditions that allow for abuse. The absence of effective supervision, the absence of rigorous internal investigations of citizen complaints, the absence of meaningful discipline when somebody is found to have committed abuse. And, you know, I urge people to go to our website, the Citizens Police Data Project, because we have various of the sort of aggregate statistics, and they're stunning. You know, the police aren't wrong. I mean, before this huge upheaval that we're in now, they weren't wrong to feel like they had virtual impunity, very little chance of being detected,
right.
if detected.
That's the big C word, the culture word that gets thrown around like, how are we going to change the culture? That's right. what we're talking about.
Right.
The idea of how police officers are being supervised, how they feel when they are in situations where it's gray.
Yeah.
You know, and how they react to
that. And I think the other thing that's important to point out is, and I say this with no intent to minimize how grave the problem is. In fact, I think this is a way of emphasizing it, that, and we have statistics that demonstrate this, the very substantial majority of police officers don't get a lot of complaints. I don't have the exact numbers at the top of my head, but it's roughly 80, you know, upwards of 80% of police officers in the course of their entire careers get between 0 and 4 complaints. 90% of officers get less than 10 complaints. But then there are, you know, other officers and almost always groups of officers, because this is not police abuse. Serious police abuse is very rarely an individual lone wolf kind of thing. It's groups. It's
right.
teams of officers. And you have officers who have extraordinary numbers of complaints. And again, we've had instances of officers who are finally criminally prosecuted. They stumble and get caught and are criminally prosecuted. And they're not caught by their department. They're caught by some other, you know, agency of law enforcement. And then there's a look back at their complaint history.
Right.
And you realize, I mean, you remember the special operations scandal in 2007. You look back at the history, and Jerry Finnegan, who was the kind of alpha dog in that racket within the special operations section, had, I don't know, 60, 70 complaints that were, none of which had ever been sustained. He'd never been disciplined. And you looked at what he was ultimately criminally charged with and convicted of, and all of the complaints, the vast majority of complaints, were for that precise conduct. And they'd just been blown off. So there were so many points at which the system could have intervened and stopped
but
him.
But it didn't. And
but
that's
it didn't.
But I guess, like you said, I mean, this is not, you're not talking about a low-rent theater company that doesn't know who their boss is.
Yeah.
This is the police department. Yeah. There are levels of management at every stage.
Right.
I mean,
so it's a broken. I mean,
I don't
used
know
to
how,
say,
yeah.
I used to say, actually, I almost said it again out of habit. I used to say of the sort of accountability system and regime that it was a broken system. And then I realized that doesn't really describe it. You know, broken suggests that it sort of malfunctioned. This is a system that's a well, or was until it blew up recently, mm-hmm. you know, a well-functioning system, but for ends that were antithetical to the public interest. This was a system for making complaints go away. Think if you were a corporation and you have customers and you have tens of thousands of complaints from your customers. I mean, that actually is precious information. Corporations call that quality control. It matters to your bottom
right.
line. It matters to your efficacy. To, you know, so what's been so dysfunctional about this dimension of the police department and related agencies is that they've kind of blinded themselves to information of immense value, and not just to citizens who might be abused, but to the officers themselves. You know, officers can sometimes just kind of drift into patterns of behavior. And if there were an intervention, if there were a serious,
we heard about that,
a serious reprimand. Jason Van Dyke.
You hear about the overworked or in situations.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
just like,
and you're stressed out and something.
Yeah.
But you know, an intervention, or you get drawn into the wrong cohort of officers who are dirty, a young officer. The extraordinary thing, so they have all of this information coming from complaints, tens of thousands of complaints, and they do no pattern analysis, by which I mean if an officer had a lot of complaints, you would intervene. If a group of officers had a significant number of complaints each, so it can't just be a statistical anomaly, something's going on with that group. If an officer who's otherwise been apparently doing fine has a sudden spike in complaints, and very importantly, the particular character of the complaints. It's not just the number of complaints. You know, if you had an officer had, say, 8 complaints and they were all for sexual assault or you know, I mean, there are, that's a pretty pronounced, and they're all coming from different individuals who don't know each other. That's really significant information, and it, and the system has consistently just kind of blown it off, made it disappear.
Or didn't organize it, or underfunded didn't find it to be a priority in the police department. What you're doing with this data, I mean, this seems to have municipal advantage in the way that, you know, the police department could use the pattern analysis and be able to go, well, what we're trying a bad idea. Don't do that anymore. Right?
What we're trying to do, actually, with the project, in addition to just providing a tool for people who can use it, is it's a demonstration project of what the city and what the police department could be doing with this data if they were to connect the dots, if they wanted to turn data into meaningful knowledge for, you know, managing this, this institution and its relationship with citizens. And, you know, and that is a, I mean, again, I urge people to look at the site. It's a really fascinating ongoing project to show what this information,
you know,
be.
This is, I think, the, I believe it's the third time you've been on with me in this less than a year. And every time I'm like, oh, you got to come in studio. Now I'm like, next, you got to come back and we got to do like 2 hours. Like, sure, just sure. Make this a Jamie Calvin show. Let me ask you, because, you know, I kind of hinted at you have a background in advocacy and activism because you worked on your father's project when he died in, it was mid-70s?
I was very close to my father, who was a law professor at the University of Chicago, a constitutional scholar, and wrote a great deal about the First Amendment. He died very young, you know, substantially younger than I am now. And in the last years of his life was working on a sort of intellectual history of the First Amendment. But he was a very, he wrote a lot for magazines. He wasn't an academic type writer. And he died in the middle of this book that he had invested so much of himself in and left a 1,400 page first draft. It was incomplete and with gaps. And I spent more than a decade just immersing myself in First Amendment law, in his work, and finishing that book. And it was published in the late 80s under the title A Worthy Tradition.
Let me ask you, you know, for the work that you spent in First Amendment to the work that you're doing now on the street, giving voice to the voiceless, you know, do they have similarities? Do they connect? Or is there a time for you, which one do you prefer?
You know, it's actually very continuous for me. I mean, that work on my father's book was this incredible immersion, and I think a formative, truly formative phase in my life that's foundational for everything that comes after. And he had this notion that the First Amendment was not just a body of law, but was a tradition of the society, which means every generation has to renew that tradition. And when I finished the book, you know, I had weirdly, I'm not a lawyer, I'd weirdly become this kind of expert in the First Amendment that time. And there were, you know, there were law schools that were prepared to shape programs for me. And, you know, and I had this sort of obvious avenue to be the kind of journalist who comments on First Amendment cases and write, you know, and that's this kind of journalistic niche. Mm-hmm. And there are a few moments in life, there are occasional moments in people's lives where you just sort of make a kind of clear decision that it's not just the half-conscious moving through life. And I had this moment of realizing that my life was really about the First Amendment, but that I wanted to dedicate it to exercising the First Amendment rather than writing about it, you know, as commentary. And I've ended up, obviously, you know, doing both. But so I have the continuity, I think, for me is I have a sense of sort of vocation under the First Amendment, you know, and I think
in theory,
all journalists should. But I think in practice, you know, especially at this difficult time in journalism, it's, you know, though that tradition is not in great shape.
Let me ask you this, Jamie, as we wrap up in the last minutes here. You know, I always ask guests at the big table about Chicago. About what it means, because you spent your whole life here, and you've seen a Chicago that a lot of people listening at WGN Radio haven't.
Right.
Talk about, what do you think of how has the city inspired you, and what do you think Chicago is to Jamie Calvin?
Well, you know, it's so fun. You know, so we referred earlier to a lawsuit, the title of which is Calvin versus Chicago. I love the city. I'm a native of the city. I live within a couple of blocks of the different places I grew up in. When I walk the dogs, I walk under trees that I learned to ride a bike under, or, you know, waddled under as a little kid. I mean, I have, you know, this incredible sense of place. And my sense of place extends to communities like Stateway Gardens and Robert Taylor. I mean, that was part of my sense of place. But at the same time, you know, this city really bruises you. It really bruises you. And I've come to feel like it's, I'm not sure privilege is the word, but there's something, if you know, the great issues of race and class and how we organize cities are the defining issues in American life, then one of the things about living in Chicago, and it's both, you know, the privilege and the bruising part of it, is in your face all the time. It's
all
accessible,
the time, yeah.
And you can engage it. You might live in Montana, you know, and there's still the great issues in American life, but you don't have the ability to engage with them. So for me, that's, you know, meant a great deal. I would add, though, that at this moment, which is a moment of historic possibility, I mean, really extraordinary possibility for profound and enduring change. We'll have to, you know, sustain it, find the political will. A lot of statesmanship will be required of everybody. But I think a cop said this to me, you know, a really admirable police officer who's a good friend and, in fact, one of the rarest things, a whistleblower within the department. And she said to me recently, you know, we live in a broken city. And I think right now we live in a broken city. And it's on all of us. That the challenge of healing and repairing a broken city isn't just for the mayor and the police superintendent, and it isn't just for the particular communities most affected by this kind of abuse. I think all of us now live in a broken city, and if we care about the city and care about each other, we need to engage that.
Jamie Calvin's a writer and a human rights activist. He's the man behind the Invisible Institute and the Citizens Police Data Project, which just won the